Monday night edition here of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. I'm joined as often by Danny LaRue for our patented 15 in kind of sort of about 60 minutes or so. Today we're doing the Western Conference. What's up, Danny?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Just got back from the Warriors-Hornets game where the Warriors kind of looked like their whole selves for the first time in quite a while, with Barnes being back at least to play with the second unit as a backup four. And the Hornets, actually, I thought played really well when you consider that Batum wasn't available. But anyway, that's about that. We can talk more about that when we get to the Warriors. We're actually going to start at the bottom of the alphabet today with the now 15-18 Utah Jazz.
Yeah, so they're 4-4 in their last eight since the last time we did this. And I think overall they've looked better than I anticipated without Rudy Gobert, and it looks like he's going to come back at some point soon. We don't know exactly when because Andy Larson said that he was seen on the practice floor. We don't exactly know what to mean of that, but at least that's something.
Yeah, and we saw him even when they were here about a week and a half ago, at least, you know, doing some pregame work with a brace on, but to be moving around okay with that MCL injury. But, you know, one thing that's been disappointing is basically since November, you know, about since he went out, essentially, they've been really, you know, in the bottom five or so in defense. And last year, when they had that awesome stretch to end the year post-cancer, they were defending extremely well, even when he was off the court. So the fact that they haven't been able to keep that up and then it's fallen to such depths has been disappointing. But when you also consider kind of the lack of firepower that this team has, the fact that they've been able to keep it kind of mid-pack on offense during that period is also encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, they've gotten better than expected contributions from Trevor Booker and Jeff Withey. For me, Booker's the one who's been a little bit more surprising, just because I don't know. That's not true. Withey's way more surprising because Withey's actually been decent.
You know, I don't know. Actually, I mean, Trevor Booker, I'm torn on him, right? Because there are games where he is awesome with his energy. And where he will, especially during that period, like one of those games was, I think, when they're at Denver about a month ago. He was fantastic, really, against a Denver bench unit, just killed them, and got on the offensive glass. He is getting 13% of available offensive rebounds, which is absolutely outstanding for any player, not to mention a power forward who's about 6'6", essentially, as Booker is. But when he's not having that kind of a game, he's contributing very little. He's shooting 42% on two-pointers, which is very discouraging for a guy who basically should be a pretty low-usage guy and should be getting a lot of his plays around the rim. So I don't know. I mean, I think he was even kind of stretched to be a third big, and now that he has had to be a starter, they weren't doing so well. But now with the emergence of Withey, they've been going with him at center and favors as the four to start again.
Yeah, the emergence of Jeff Withey is probably right. He's doing well both defensively, which isn't as surprising. It's his much-typed volleyball skills are actually contributing. He's 14th in defensive RPM right now among centers, and he's scoring more efficiently than you would expect.
Yeah, that's true. Now, you know, he's sort of very much like a very, very poor man's Rudy Gobert, although he does actually lead in Nylon Calculus's rim protection statistics now that he has enough minutes to qualify. 7.7% two-point block percentage, which is excellent. That's like league leader type of performance. And letting Favors start at power forward, I think, helps the offense some because Favors is more of a bully. He can post up opposing fours. I mean, they'll probably end up going with defensively. Teams will do the same thing they did when Gobert was starting and put their four-man on Withey. But Withey can get free for, you know, the occasional alley-oop or something. Not going to give you much offense aside from that. It really is pretty remarkable, aside from that he doesn't move his feet quite as well as Gobert, that he can give them just a little bit less of everything that Gobert gives them. And that's encouraging for Utah because they got him completely off the scrap heap and they had to cut a guaranteed contract in Grant Jarrett just to keep him.
Yeah, they did. And also, he's a guy that is nice to have for them because you don't want him ideally as a starter. But if he can do similar things, you know, be a Rudy Light in 15 minutes a game, that would be more than enough for them when they're even moderately close to healthy, which they might not be for a while.
Do you see any team catching the Jazz for the eighth seed? I think Houston moved into seventh by beating them today. Is that right? And now they're eighth?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, those two teams are locked in a quote-unquote battle right now for the seventh and eighth seeds in the West, but pretty much all of those teams below them have just been sputtering like crazy.
I don't expect any of them to, but you are running into kind of the law of large numbers where like one of the four or five teams can break out. There are a couple teams that I don't think it's going to be, and we'll talk about them in the near future. But, you know, a team like the Pelicans or the Blazers or somebody could, but I wouldn't expect it. I would take them over. I would take both those teams over the field right now.
Yeah, well, we'll get to a couple of those teams, as you said, but let's start with the San Antonio Spurs. 30-6, 7-1 since we last checked in on them. Big blowout win at the Bucks. It was close for a half, and then they just put them away in the second half and ended up winning by over 25 points. I think the statistic was that they've already won 8 or more games, something ridiculous like that, by 25 points or more. And they have the best net rating in the league despite 4 more losses than Golden State does. I think that overall, though, they haven't played any of these other top four title contenders. If you look at Golden State, Oklahoma City, and Cleveland since opening night, they've not had the hardest schedule. But on the other hand, you know, nobody has really had that hard of a schedule because there's only 4 teams that you really look like as a contender.
And those teams haven't really played much of each other, and they're beating up on everybody else. I think John Schulman had that about how the West, basically the rest of the West, is falling behind because they're just losing to the Warriors, Thunder, and Spurs a lot. And what I've been thinking about, you had a nice little conversation with Jim Peterson about the Spurs, and I've thought for the last, let's say, 2 years about how the Spurs defense matches up with the Warriors offense. I think that is the more intellectually interesting concept for me, but the Spurs offense against the Warriors defense might actually be not necessarily more important, but a real challenge for San Antonio now.
Yeah, I do. And they are third in offensive rating. They had been second for a time. But they don't really do anything incredibly well except just make two-pointers. And they're not even getting a ton of shots at the rim. But, you know, Tony Parker has largely abandoned shooting threes now. He's shooting an amazing percentage on twos. Kawhi Leonard, we talked about what he's been able to do. He's shooting a high percentage on threes as well. But, you know, not a ton of volume. This team is, you know, I think in the 20s in terms of three-pointers taken per game, or I can't remember if it's taken or made, but, you know, shooting a lot less threes than they have in past years. LaMarcus, he's basically right back to where he was percentage-wise in Portland, except he's taking a few more shots at the rim, getting on the offensive glass a little bit more. But, you know, a lot of what they've been able to do offensively is based on making twos, and a lot of those twos are outside of the restricted area. That is, and they shoot a great percentage on those, but that is really one of the offensive indicators that is most likely to fluctuate both on the individual player level and the team level. I mean, even going back to some of John Hollinger's earliest work, he showed that two-point percentage from year to year among players is something that can change a lot. And so, you know, I think they have some great players that they could continue to shoot at this rate, but I think that is something to look at, is whether they can continue hitting shots that, you know, despite the Spurs' reputation, are not inherently the most efficient shots in basketball.
And you think about the idea of, well, how can they do something so well that somebody can't take it away? And yeah, they might be pretty good at shooting twos, but that's not really one of those things. You know, like you think about the Warriors shooting threes, or maybe a certain team's transition offense. And so, yeah, I think it's something to think about, and it's a little bit weird that we're having so much time where the Spurs aren't playing any of those elite teams. And that's not a criticism. That's just the way the schedule works. And so I'm going to try to watch them a little bit more closely. Also, setting up later in this month, they have a big stretch where they face the Warriors, the Rockets, and the Cavs back to back to back. Not 3 consecutive days, obviously, but just those are their 3 consecutive games. And just to see how they can handle that type of game, because that's going to reflect more of what we're going to see with them. Because really, we haven't seen a Spurs team at full throttle in the playoffs since they won that title going away.
You know, I actually would disagree with you in that. But when you say this, it's something that's hard to take away. I think actually long twos are the hardest thing in basketball to take away if another team is really good at it, because defenses are so focused on protecting the rim and the three-point line, and long twos are shots that you can always get one-on-one, you can't really double team to take those away without completely compromising your defense. So guys like LaMarcus and Kawhi, if they can hit those shots against really good defense, which the Warriors will provide with guys like Iguodala and Green, then, you know, it is really hard to stop. But on the other hand, maybe they won't shoot as good of a percentage against a really good defensive team like Golden State. One other thing on the Spurs, they had a net rating for the month of December, which was over 20. I think the NBA.com stats only go back to the 96-97 season, and that was the best month by over 4 points per 100 possessions in terms of net rating. I think the next best month was the November of 96 Bulls that had like a 16 net rating, and they were over 20. So this is basically, just in terms of net rating, their December was like the best month that we have on record since those stats became available.
Awesome.
All right, what's next? Sacramento, 14-20, 3-4 in their last seven.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. When we were putting this together for the original recording, there was that reporting out there about that they were maybe interested in trading the guys, but for whatever reason it wasn't, including DeMarcus Cousins. And so you're thinking about that, and then tonight they beat the Thunder, so you don't know if that's going to, you know, kind of push the apple cart again or change it over, but that's just the way the Kings are.
Yeah, this was actually the first time they have ever beaten Oklahoma City in Oklahoma City.
Wow.
Was today, yeah.
Well, actually, that kind of no, because that's true. Oklahoma City's first season there, they weren't particularly good from what I remember. They got better right after that.
Yeah, yeah, they were horrible, but, you know, the Kings weren't any good either.
Correct.
So in that that 07, or I'm sorry, 08-09 year was their first year in Oklahoma City. But, yeah, you know, you pose the question of who on this team is really an asset on their contract right now. You know, I mean, that like we're and I think when you think about a real asset, I say if we're really talking about it, I'd say, all right, if you traded this guy, you could get at least a first-round pick for him. And I don't know. No, Willie Cauley-Stein you could get a first-round
for
pick
sure.
For. You know, maybe like a top-5 protected, top-10 protector or something like that. But other than he and Cousins, I don't think that there is necessarily anyone on this team.
I mean, maybe if you loved Rudy Gay. But what
How many years does he have left? He has two more years left?
I think he has 2 years
one?
After this at a reasonable.
And one of them is a player option.
Yeah, I think it's like 225 or something in that range.
Yeah, so, but Gay is getting to be, I mean, he's kind of moved into really being almost a pure power forward at this point. You know, his passing limitations we're aware of. I don't think he really has the lateral quickness to stay with a lot of threes or shooters on the perimeter at this point. I mean, I think the combination that he's been in with Caspi, where both of them are just sort of forwards rather than one being the four and one being the three, has worked really well. But if he had to go back to being a pure three at this point, I think he might be a little bit too slow for that, especially he's not going to be able to take guys like that off the dribble anymore. So I don't know. I mean, I think he's kind of fairly paid, but not someone that maybe you could get a first-round pick for a team that really needed some scoring punch on the wing, but because he doesn't play that much defense, it's kind of hard to say that you really would be fired up to have him on a winning team.
Yeah, it would be a niche market for sure, but yeah, that gets into the bigger point just with Sacramento, with, you know, they have guys, Bellinelli, Darren Collison, McLemore, that aren't really on bad contracts, but they're not sitting there screaming, take me, though if they really wanted to move those guys next summer when teams are spending money on probably worse than those guys, that's different, but that's not during this season with teams' current limitations.
Yeah, so they've had some interesting lineup issues, especially with some of the injuries that they've had, Cousins not playing a ton, and then his injuries, Cauley-Stein being out of it as well. But, you know, of their lineups that have been used, which have been successful?
So there are two lineups that they have in their top 10 that are actually in net rating are plus 29 or better, which is kind of shocking when you think about it. And it's even more, to a degree, even more shocking when you hear what the lineups are. So their most successful lineup in only 54 minutes is Rondo, McLemore, Rudy Gay, Willie Cauley-Stein, and Cousins. And so that was
a unit that started
right
for them for a
that
time
was their,
early
yeah,
on.
Yeah, that did pretty well. But then the crazier one is Rondo, Bellinelli, Caspi, Cousins, and Kufos. And you're sitting there going like, Well, how is that lineup? And that lineup is plus 29.1.
Yeah, I mean, those are the units that I actually killed. And Kufos is really negative overall. Not that he's played a ton with Cousins, but those two big lineups are the ones that I thought would be totally unsuccessful with them, especially the Kufos one. That one doesn't really make much sense to me. But, you know, I think that's a lot of that's probably randomness, but at least the Cauley-Stein-Cousins combo, Cauley-Stein can get out on shooters. When you're playing Cousins and Kufos together and Cousins has to guard the other team's four man who can shoot threes, I think that's generally going to be a disaster. So I wouldn't expect to see that continue. And those are small enough samples that we can't really put much stock in either of them. But it is interesting to note that. And, you know, we'll have to see whether that continues very much. You know, we talked about what some of their assets are. One of those guys is Ben McLemore. Like, what do you think of him at this point?
I would feel, you know, I would feel like he could still play better than he is right now, but if somebody's willing to give me basically any significant asset for him, I would be ready to move on because he's...
Well, would you trade him for a decent second-round pick?
Yeah, I would. Because...
I don't think I would. I think just because he has a little bit more potential. I think there's still sort of like the bare bones of a player there. Although, I mean, he is getting up to the point where he's going to need an extension now. But, I mean, maybe you might be able to sort of do the Jeremy Lamb thing with him and get him on a cheap deal. Hope that he's, you know, a bench wing who can defend okay and maybe could mature into a starter, you know, and you get him on the cheap for a few more years even after these next two. So I don't think I would do it for a second-round pick because he does shoot well on threes and have decent athleticism. But, you know, there are some really disappointing aspects to him in, you know, just his feel for the game overall.
Yeah, he could certainly get better, but he's at that level where you might not feel comfortable betting on it. And you're right that if you can get him at a value moving forward, that is definitely a nice thing to have. Lamb is probably the best example of where that can go in a positive direction. But McLemore doesn't have, you know, like when you think about how he's going to handle things like closeouts and everything, like he does certain things well, but I don't think he can build off of that into being a starter. You know, he could be a rotation player, and there's a value in that, especially with what we've talked about before as a running theme on the show, is the lack of depth on the wing. Like, there is a value to him, but if, let's say, what I was thinking of a strong first-round pick, I was thinking of a pick that's likely 31 to 35, maybe 36 to 40, like that kind of thing. And for me...
Yeah, second-round
pick.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so I think that type of a thing, even in a weaker draft this year... You're getting a guy on a very team-friendly contract for another 4 years, and, you know, maybe there's a 1-in-4 chance they become a starter, but I think that's probably about what the odds are right now for McLemore.
Yeah, I think he has a little bit more upside than those guys. You know, the chances of him becoming a star, I think we can pretty much punt on that for now, you know, even living up to his draft position as number 7 in what was, to be fair, a weak draft. But the thing is, other than just shooting a jump shot, standing in place for three, maybe coming off a screen every once in a while, although he's never really been that great at that either. Maybe that's something he can develop. But basically, and getting out in transition, you know, he's gotten a little bit better there. But anytime he tries to do anything off the dribble, it's a complete disaster. So when he handles the ball in the pick and roll, he has 10 points on 22 possessions, and turns it over one-third of the time. And when he's in a spot-up situation, when he just shoots it, he's pretty decent efficiency. But when he drives out of spot-ups, he will turn it over nearly 40% of the time. So basically, any time that he's putting the ball on the floor, it's going to be a turnover. He's going to throw up some wild shot. He has no passing vision at all, really, either. So... While he can jump, he's not able to apply that in any way because he can't get to the basket well enough to actually finish over. He's not even a good finisher on the rare occasions that he will get there either. You know, he doesn't kind of have the feel for moving the ball around and avoiding shot blockers. You know, he just kind of jumps as high as he can and tries to figure it out. And, you know, a lot of times he'll just get the ball tipped away by smaller players or something. So I don't know. I think defensively he has some tools. I think he's come along a little bit there. But, you know, still low usage, pretty average efficiency, and, you know, I think it's time to basically forget about him as your shooting guard of the future in Sacramento. Maybe you keep him around, hope he develops into something, but if you're coming up with a long-term plan now in Sacramento, Marco Bellinelli is older, doesn't defend well enough. As you noted in our outline, he's basically dead last in defensive RPM. Is that among shooting guards?
No, that's among everyone.
Yeah, that's bad.
I mean, it's a noisy stat with this little of a sample size, but that when you're dead last, that's bad.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you're at the extremes, it's pretty. There's usually some fire there along with that smoke in that stat, even in a small sample size. And so now you really have to say, hey, we drafted a shooting guard number 7 overall in 2013. We drafted another shooting guard number 8 overall in 2014. And guess what? We still need a shooting guard for our long-term plan here in Sacramento. It's pretty sad.
It's the shallowest position in the league, probably.
Yeah. Before we move on to the Portland Trailblazers, let me take some time to tell you about the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked Up Basketball Podcast, SeatGeek. Whether you're looking to buy tickets to a game or sell tickets that you can't use, you should check out SeatGeek, which is the smartest way to buy and sell tickets for your favorite sports team. I've been using it. We've gotten some nice tweets from people who have been using it as well to support the program and also get cheap tickets or sell their tickets. And what makes SeatGeek so special is it aggregates all of the ticket buying sites together in one place that enables you to not have to worry that, oh, I might have missed my chance at getting cheaper tickets because I didn't check out this site. Now you can relax, don't have to worry about it. The relevant sites are in one place, and they will tell you whether it's a good deal or a bad deal based on all the other available tickets with their metric called deal score. You get a nice little green dot if it's good. If it's not that great of a deal, you get a red dot. And if you're trying to sell tickets, SeatGeek has the lowest fees of any ticket site out there and always shows you the full price up front. Finally, the best part is my listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. If you download the free SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab and click add a promo code. You enter that promo code CAPSPACE, which everyone who listens to the show knows by now. We talk about it all the time. It's all one word, CAPSPACE. And then SeatGeek will send you $20 once you've made your first ticket purchase. So download the free SeatGeek app, enter promo code CAPSPACE today, save money on tickets, make money on your tickets, support the program, everybody wins.
And we'll move on to a team that is going to have some interesting games if you're in town, the Portland Trailblazers, because they've been 4-4 since we talked about them last, 15-22, and their next three games are home games against the Clippers, Warriors, and Thunder.
Yeah, and they got really throttled by Memphis today. Offensively, they had played a back-to-back, and then they came back west. They played in Denver, had a nice win last night, which we talked about on yesterday's program. And then, you know, second game of a back-to-back in Portland, pretty long flight from in Denver to Portland. And finally, the magic ran out with Lillard, who had missed his seventh, or I guess, did he play today? I don't think he did.
I believe he did not play today.
Yeah, so that would be his eighth straight game.
Oh, he did play.
Oh, he did.
35 minutes,
wow,
17
surprising.
Points on 14 shots.
Huh. All right, well, there goes my whole thing of, oh, they were barely keeping it together with C.J. McCollum, and finally that ran out. But nonetheless, to be 4-4 in their last eight with Lillard having missed seven of those games is very remarkable. McCollum had been doing a great job. Guys like Alan Crabb and some of the other bench guys keeping him afloat while McCollum was out of the game for rare stretches. And they're not out of it yet at 15-22. They're really, you know, only like 2-3 games behind the Jazz. Their fundamentals are looking pretty decent as far as what their point differential is. So they are by no means out of the playoff race. I think they would probably prefer to be, frankly, especially because they have that lottery protected pick that they owe to the Nuggets from the Apollo trade. But you know, how are they doing it right now?
They're one of the big things that was surprising to me when pulling some stuff on them is that in December they were the fourth best offensive rebounding team in the league, and the big engine behind that was Ed Davis. So Ed Davis in December had a 15.5% offensive rebound rate. And you talked about how Trevor Booker was in the 13 range, and that was really good. Well, 15.5 is a whole lot better. And the only regular rotation guys who had like the full sample size who did better in that month were Zaza Pachulia, Andre Drummond, and Enes Kanter. So that's a great number.
Yeah, those are some of the best guys offensive rebounding in the league, and Davis did a great job in that Denver game that we talked about with the second unit, kind of keeping balls alive. And Vonleh is a much better offensive rebounder than Myers Leonard. Vonleh went into the starting lineup and has remained there, although he hasn't gotten a ton of tick outside of those starting stints in each half. Alan Crabb has been a nice find for them. He was an early second-round pick. He's showing that he's at least can be a solid rotation guy. I'm not sure that he is someone who's going to be a starter necessarily. I think, you know, he shot the ball well from three-point range, but he still has a below-average usage, never gets any rebounds or any assists, and he's 23 already, so, you know, I think he came out after his junior year. He's an okay defender. He'll get out in transition a reasonable amount, but not quite a well-rounded enough game, I don't think, to be a guy that you really would feel great about as your starter. Certainly someone who could start in a pinch, and he's been providing some shooting and, you know, a little bit more offense, especially with Lillard being out. But, you know, still, I mean, that's a guy who's a second-round pick, making the minimum. You get a guy who can contribute in the rotation, start in a pinch. That's a very nice find, and the fact that he's done so well, you know, makes you kind of wonder about that Aflalo trade, whether Aflalo really even would have given them more than Crabb did. But, you know, that was obviously a different time when they were looking for to try and contend, and that all went awry.
He's a guy, and you see this around the league, another example of it might be Kyle Singler, where he was such a good value on his original contract that you worry a little bit about his second one, especially with where the league is going financially. But he's been a nice player for them this year, and you don't have to worry about that now. You can appreciate it for what it is. And another guy who's going to transition from being underpaid to being some kind of paid is Myers Leonard, who it feels to me like when I watch them play that he does that. I still love his pick and pop ability, particularly at center. Like, there's something intellectually intriguing about him, but everything else is a big old question mark.
It's tough for Myers because playing at the four, especially, he is mostly going to just be spotting up at the 3-point line. Like, that's what he can really do at the four. He does not have any post up ability at all, really. So, you know, him taking smaller guys down on the block, like, that's really usually going to be a win for the defense. He hasn't been effective there. He's actually only shooting 54% at the rim, but maybe, and that's obviously not very good, especially for a 7-footer when the league averaged 59%, 60%. But even more troubling is how small of a sample it is at the rim. He's taking less than 10% of his shots at the rim. This is a guy who was drafted as, you know, supposedly a really athletic 7-footer, and he's shooting, you know, he has 4 dunks the whole year, and he's basically never shooting around the rim. Maybe it would be different if he were a center. He could have more chances to roll as well as to pop. But other than just his jump shot, and he's also shooting pretty well on twos outside the restricted area, and 32% on threes. He's really not doing anything in the floor game or at the basket on either end that makes you feel great about what he's able to do. But, you know, I think he's another one of these guys. Kaminsky maybe even is another one where they're just a little bit more effective at the five, and their teams just have a lot of fives, and so they have to play four.
And it's a little concerning also if you think on a broader perspective with them, because their other fours don't really complement him well in terms of the fact that if you really were scared about Leonard as a pick and pop guy, you can just put your four on him and put your five on Ed Davis or put your five on Vonleh, and I think you'd be all right. Kind of like what teams do, as you mentioned before, about Derek Favors. That isn't a guarantee that it will be that way forever, of course, but I think you need the right players around somebody like Myers Leonard. And as I've written before in draft pieces, the problem with that is if a guy is not good enough to build around in that sense, it's mostly just serendipity. And you hope that it works out. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Like, kind of like tonight with Mo Spates and the Warriors. And that's a challenge if you're Myers Leonard, because very few teams are going to invest what they need to put you in the right position, because you're not worth that.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, I think he still does have some of the physical ability. He did have that pretty nasty shoulder injury, and he looked like, I didn't see the game, but Kevin Pelton tweeted that he may have aggravated that a little bit tonight. So that's always going to reduce someone's aggressiveness, those sorts of shoulder injuries as well, especially when you kind of injure it in a scrum the way that he did. So I don't know. We'll see how he kind of ends the year, but he just has not shown enough to make me feel like, all right, this guy can hold up well enough in the other facets of the game to be more than kind of like a backup center type of guy. So you remember back when we did the over-under podcasts and Phoenix's was 36.5. I took the over, and you said basically, I'm taking the under. I can't really articulate it, but something just seems like it's off with this team. That turned out to be quite prescient.
I believe the term I used was disaster potential, which if I did, I'm going to be so pleased with myself because that's what this is.
Yeah, and when I had Paul Coro on for their preview, which was pretty early on, it was like right after training camp started, the party line was Markieff Morris, everything was going to be okay with him. I didn't quite buy that, but even then I still probably bought it too much, frankly, with how he's played, all the rumblings that have come out of there. Robert Sarver had those comments today, which were preposterous, frankly, talking about how millennials like can't deal with disappointment, which inspired quite a few rounds of guffaws on Twitter, including, what kind of generation trades away like 3 years worth of first round picks and then also, gives up another 2 first rounders to get rid of Kurt Thomas to stay out of the luxury tax.
With a good team.
But try and put this in perspective for me, how bad they've been. I mean, they're 12-25. They've lost 8 straight now. We're getting to really where they've been kind of the worst team in the league for quite a while now.
Yeah, so Ben Golliver of Sports Illustrated wrote a really nice piece about this. He was at the abomination that was the Lakers-Suns game on Sunday. And the way he put it was that since the losing streak began, I think they've lost 9 straight. They've been the worst team in the league in net rating. They've been outscored by 14.6 points per 100 possessions. And part of that is they've been the second worst defensive team and the third worst offensive team. And what makes it more egregious is that this isn't a situation where they're losing to good teams. They're getting whooped by the Spurs or the Warriors or whatever. Five of their losses includes losses to 5 of the 9 worst teams. I think they might have even lost to one of them more than once. And so they're losing badly to bad teams, and they're. When you watch, and I mean, even when you watch it, they look a little bit listless too. A little bit might be charitable. And so they're just, it's a bunch of different problems at the same time.
Yeah, it's all the more galling. I mean, now that Bledsoe is out, it's truly become hopeless. But it was all the more galling because they had some really nice performances. They beat the Bulls on the road. Then I think they beat the Raptors right after that as well. It looked like, they were like 12-14 or something. They just got back from an East Coast trip. It looked like, for all intents, that they were going to actually stay in it toward this kind of stunted West playoff race until the end, and then all of a sudden they had this incredible losing streak that's just, and a lot of it kind of started with that first game against the Warriors where they gave up, some ridiculous amount and lost by 40, but they're really, and Tyson Chandler, I think, being hurt has contributed to as well, but really incredibly disappointing for this franchise now. And now it's kind of time to just see what they have in terms with guys like TJ Warren and Devin Booker. And maybe, I guess you could say Alex Len as well. Although I think, they kind of do know what they have in him. So, a shame to see a team that had talent. And I think should, with some of the guys that they have, be able to kind of at least stay on the fringe of this West playoff race, but they're clearly done now at this point.
Yeah, it's a good thing they can look forward to that top 3 protected Lakers pick.
Yeah. Kevin Durant out with a toe injury. He's missed 6 games already with that hamstring. Obviously having an unbelievable year, but basically in the games without him, they were 3-3, pretty much an even net rating. And they got waxed pretty badly by the Kings, gave up $120 to them at home. I think they actually really miss him defensively as well because they don't have anybody else on the wing who can do anything two-way. If it's not going to be Robertson, who can't score at all, then you're going with 2 guys and Waiters, and whether it's Singler or Morrow, those guys can't stop anybody. And so they gave up a ton of points to the Kings in really just a reminder of perhaps despite all of the money that they've spent and the resources they put in, how thin this team actually is.
There's a reason why they don't play the Kevin Durant at the four, Ibaka at the five lineup that so many of us would love to see, and the reason is that they don't have the guys to play at the two and the three.
Yeah, you know, that's a fair point, right? Like, Steven Adams is probably just a better basketball player than any of their wings are.
Sure.
You know, any of their non-Durant wings are.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're in that spot, and they just, and all their guys are just significantly flawed. Like, it's not like they're one of those guys who maybe they're, the example I might use is Quincy Pondexter. Like, Quincy Pondexter is not dominant in anything, but he's, you know, he's pretty good at everything. They don't have any guys like that. Almost every single wing they have other than Durant has this just gigantic flaw, which keeps them from being a starter, which keeps them from being somebody that teams are going to give up assets for. That's not to say they're a bad basketball player, but putting those guys together is hard because you're almost always going to give another team an out.
They have been awesome on the offensive glass. As you noted, they're the best offensive rebounding team in the league in December, but that hasn't happened on the defensive glass.
Yeah, it's a kind of one of those things that I want to watch now. It was one of the fun things about doing 15 and 60 is I start digging for stuff. And when I found that is, so the last couple of years, they were top half of the league. So that they in defensive rebounding and they were third from the bottom in December. So
yeah. And they should be good, right? I mean, they're playing Steven Adams a lot. Cantor is better on the offensive glass, but not terrible generally on the defensive glass. Serge Ibaka should be a good defensive rebounder. KD is one of the best rebounding small forwards. Russell Westbrook is one of the best rebounding point guards. To actually be that bad on the defensive glass is pretty pathetic for this team, frankly.
Yeah, so you think it'll work out. I mean, I think the expectation is that they'll be better, but you just kind of want to look at it a little bit and just see where it goes. And I think it's an aberration. It's just one of those things when you play 15, 16 games, sometimes you can have a bad stretch. But if it persists, that's something to think about. Because they won a ton of games in the stretch. It's not like they were losing because of it. I mean, they were winning games. But it's just whenever you see something like that, that's a warning sign. You just want to keep it in the back of your brain, and then if it persists, then it becomes a red flag.
Yeah, and my theory on this, which I will try to watch and see whether it's right or not, is just that they give up so much penetration that it's really more the type of shots they are allowing, because shots at the rim, for example, are much easier to offensive rebound than, you know, mid-range twos. And threes, actually, if I recall correctly, will be rebounded better than twos are, long twos are a lot of times. But I think part of that is just because you have the defense scrambling when you're taking an open three, as opposed to a long two is kind of more, the defense is a little bit more set and can kind of see it coming and box out. So I think probably it's more than just a lack of effort. It's just the type of shots that they are allowing, the type of scrambling that they are doing defensively is what's leading to that. But we'll see whether that actually is true or not when I look a little bit more closely. The Pelicans, and Oklahoma City, 24-11, 6-2 in their last eight. And, you know, I guess, do you think that we are, like, too harsh on this team?
Yeah, I think we are, because they are an awesome team. I think they were second. I think they were ahead of the Warriors. We use net rating a lot. Basically, that's just because it scales on possessions and things like that. They were by that the second best team in December. But what's hard with them is you have to kind of reconcile that you feel like they could be so much better than they are with the fact that they are really good. And also the unfortunate part of them being in the same conference as these two truly special teams is that you see them and you see how much kind of closer they are to, if you want to call it, the platonic ideal. And then the Thunder just, it makes their weaknesses so much more glaring. But when they're on, they're still incredible.
Yeah, and I've said before, I mean, I think this is very clearly either the third or fourth best team in basketball. But they just, with two top five players, with a great defensive stalwart like Serge Ibaka, with a shooter like Morrow, with, you know, the amount of resources they put into trying to improve some of the supporting cast, it feels like they should be better than they are, you know, despite the fact that they're pretty much like living up to expectations. And also just because they've played so well when KD, Russ, and Ibaka have been healthy these last few years, that they're kind of a little bit below that level still, I feel like. The Pelicans, 11-22, 3-3 in their last six, They're like starting to get it together a little bit. Not that far out of the playoffs, about four games. There are some teams between them, but none of them are playing particularly well. You know, I mean, I would say the Kings and then them are probably, I would say, the top two threats to break into the playoff picture right now. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think the door is open for them, but it's closing. And I mean, you have to think about that Utah, that this section, so they're still, Utah's still ahead of them by a margin. Utah has a non-representative part of their season. I mean, I think Rudy will be back, and Burks, you know, that's an unfortunate thing, but their overall situation, I think, will be better for the next, you know, 40 games than for the first 40 games. And so I think that you have to, you know, you're going to have to beat them and make up the margin, but they're good enough to do that. So they're going to, you know, this isn't a situation where, like, I thought it was going to take 44 wins to get in before the season started. I just thought that's where it was going to be. It is not going to be there. But they're, so they had a negative 2.9 net rating, so they got outscored a little bit per game.
This is in December.
They were, so that's about a little over 2 points better than they were in November when the wheels were kind of off the train. So for reference, Memphis and Minnesota for the whole season are about at the same place that New Orleans was for that month. And so I think that, you know, you can get from that point to the playoffs, but they're going to need to do better, particularly on the offensive glass.
Yeah, this is one of, and I think a lot, they are 15th in offense, 29th in defense so far this year by points per possession. They're barely into the top 10 offensively last year, and I think they were 22nd defensively. And I think a lot of the difference is just that they're 30th in offensive rebounding percentage this year after being 6th last year, and they've been playing the same guys. You know, AD is like 6% offensive rebounding percentage. Ryan Anderson, 7%. Omer Asik, even, I think, is a little bit lower than he was last year and hasn't played as much anyway. But those are two things, and I think a lot of AD's just reduced efficiency is not the fact that he hasn't been able to get on the offensive glass as well. And so you'd say, all right, you know, maybe that's worth it because they're going to improve the defense. But the defense has been a lot worse, too. And I think that's pretty much all coaching. Alvin Gentry, you know, his last two, three stops. I mean, the Warriors weren't quite as bad with this, but the Clippers have always been an extreme low offensive rebounding team, just as the Celtics were under Doc Rivers. That's his philosophy. And then in Phoenix, they also, in the heyday there, almost never got on the offensive glass either. But, and that's all well and good, but the problem is they're not getting any trade-off advantage on the defensive end, so they're just worse offensively. I mean, you might as well have these guys get to the glass a little bit more because you're not stopping anybody anyway.
Well, yeah, you think about the team that we saw tonight in Charlotte. Charlotte has a strategy that they don't really kill it too much on the offensive glass, but they're not getting beat in transition. So, you know, that's the choice. There are other teams that have done that, and so they're doing that. But one of the positives that you thought about was that Jrue Holiday is looking a lot better, and he, I think, is one of the keys to any success they have the rest of the way.
Yeah, he is. He's actually, you know, he's getting up on now the point where supposedly this minutes limit is going to drop off. I hope that still works okay with him. I mean, I still would want to try and keep him around 30 minutes, although, you know, you're at the point where you're just trying to make the playoffs now. It's a lot different situation, much as it was last year, where now it's just they're desperately trying to get it in and every game, and you've got guys like Dell Demps, obviously, whose job could very well depend on this with that report that Mickey Loomis is now going to become more involved. So they're going to be trying really hard to make the playoffs still. And Jrue is putting up about the same numbers as he has over the last couple of years, but it'll be interesting to see whether he can stay healthy because this plan that they've had him on has worked. He hasn't had any stress reactions. And let's see what happens once he's playing back-to-back and full minutes and really starting at point guard.
And part of that also is that they can't afford to lose him again because the replacements just aren't good.
Yeah, and they've traded away Ish Smith, still a very good trade, obviously, but Norris Cole has been, you know, one of the worst guards in basketball so far and basically has been for nearly his entire career. Let's get to the Wolves now.
Yeah, so Minnesota, 12-23 overall, 1-7 since the last discussion, including tonight's loss to the Sixers. Yeah. And where I wanted to start with this, of course, if you want to go another direction, we can, is I thought that the podcast you did with Jim Peterson, who's the color man for the Wolves, the best in the business, in my opinion, and that's no disrespect to anybody else. I just think Jim's amazing. The idea that he brought up about Zach LaVine, I think, was the most important thing that I've struggled a lot with saying. And basically, his idea was that what LaVine becomes depends a lot on the mental part of his game.
Yeah, and what Jim was saying is the coaches are trying to drill into him all the time what's a good shot and what's a bad shot. And if he's going to play with Andrew Wiggins and Karl Towns, who are supposed to be the offensive centerpieces of this team once it is fully formed, you can't have a 28% usage rate and you know, be the third banana. And so he's going to have to modify his game, or he's just going to have to come off the bench. And the hope is, with the way that he can jump, he's got a nice stroke, that he can sort of just work in secondary pick and rolls on the weak side, that he can take open threes, spot up a little bit more, you know, and less of these contested long twos unless they're late in the clock. But we'll see. You know, he hasn't really gotten to that point yet. And some guys, you know, if you're Nick Young, Jamal Crawford, those type of guys, they never get that realization. They aren't able to reduce their usage and increase their efficiency when they're playing with better players. And even when they are playing with better players, as soon as the ball touches their hands, they become the show, you know. So he's going to have to learn to get past that. And he's very young. It could well happen that he does. You know, we'll see whether he's going to have to be relegated to the bench ultimately. And, you know, maybe having more of a 3-and-D guy in the starting lineup could help. But, you know, there's no reason just from a physical standpoint that LaVine can't be that guy.
In a lot of ways, he's a great fit for what ails them in terms of the strengths and weaknesses, especially if Rubio is going to be there. Because LaVine is a terror in transition. I talk about him as a great second pass guy, meaning that if you get him the ball at the very end, he should be able to finish. He's faster than almost every two in the league. So if you use him in that. But the problem is you have to be able to get – you can't have the other negatives. And he's also been a horrendous defender his 2 years in the NBA. And you can't – I mean, you can afford a sieve more with the trio that they have in terms of Rubio, Wiggins, and Towns. But if he can smooth out his weaknesses while maintaining his strengths, he can be a fabulous player. But anything less than close to his best is both a disappointment and a disservice for those guys.
Yeah, you noted here also that LaVine and Wiggins are second and third from the bottom in defensive RPM, and Shabazz Muhammad also very close to that as well. So it really seems like, and I know that Jim was sticking up for Sam Mitchell and saying that he's saying the right things, but there are also, and I mean, you can argue that Sam's not necessarily saying some of the right things offensively with what his system entails, but there's saying the right things as part of the battle as a coach, but there's also actually getting your players to do those things. I think that the vast majority of coaches, 90% of what they're saying is kind of the same thing, but it's the guys who can actually get guys to execute, especially younger guys, especially guys who the organization is invested in, who are going to get played regardless, you know, that when you don't have the threat of playing time over them with a guy like Wiggins. Obviously, he's going to play regardless. He played a ton of minutes as a rookie. And same thing with LaVine. Now, can you actually get those guys to do what they're supposed to be doing, despite the fact that you can't really discipline them by taking them out of the game? That's what really makes a good coach. And when we see the defensive performance from some of these guys, and even Shabazz, who, you know, he can discipline, hasn't been able to get him to defend. He's another guy who physically there's no reason he shouldn't be able to defend. Part of it's because these guys are young, but part of it, too, is that they haven't shown a ton of improvement on the defensive end.
Are you ready to move on to Memphis?
Yes, but before we do so, let's do a quick break from our sponsor. All right, the Grizzlies soldiering on here, 19-17, 4-3. You noted in an earlier segment that they still have that negative 2.9 net rating, a lot of that skewed by those really bad losses very early on in the year. I mean, they're basically, you know, kind of playing like a 500 team or so. You know, they do pretty well against the bad teams. They can squeak out wins against them. They've had some really ugly efforts against some of the good teams. Let's say this team kind of ends up, you know, about here, get the sixth seed, lose 4-1, to the Thunder in the first round of the playoffs. What do they do this offseason? I mean, they've got, assuming they bring back Conley at the max, his cap hold will only be about $15 million. That'll leave him $25 million in space, but they also have a lot of the guys on this current team who are going to be free agents, and especially on the wing, and it's going to be difficult to fill those holes with only $25 million unless you kind of overpay to bring those guys back, but then you're stuck basically in the same mold that you have been with everyone just kind of getting older.
Yeah, it's really hard to do it, and you also have to think about the idea of thinking about it long term. That, you know, that you want it. They put a lot of eggs in the Brandon Wright basket, and I'm not criticizing them for that. It was a contract that we were both supportive of at the time. But the problem is, you know, if you only have a limited amount of resources to maintain or improve, if you spread that out too thin, then you're not going to get good enough guys. And if you spread it out too narrowly, then any injury is devastating. And so, I mean, my instinct is I would love to see them, you know, get, let's say, like a stretch four who can really kind of help their offense hum and maybe get, you know, more worker bee type swingmen. But at the same time, long term, that isn't good enough to make you do anything. And I mean, it's really challenging to think of, to really build a way for them to be good, to be more than good, to be great, considering they also don't have these amazing draft assets. It's not like they're sitting with a Nets pick in their back pocket.
Yeah. I mean, here's one way to look at it. Who on this team right now is a better than even bet to be better next year than they are this year, who's in the rotation? And it's basically nobody. So now you got to hope that, I mean, maybe Jermichael Green might be one guy like that, but you basically have to hope that he, Jordan Adams, Jarrell Martin, who finally got like his first NBA basket, I think, the other day after those multiple broken foots that he had. You have to hope that those guys can grow into being not only even rotation players, but starters on the wing. And then maybe, you know, for a stopgap, they might go out and overpay someone like Luol Deng, you know, maybe try and bring back Courtney Lee, although he's 29. Eric Gordon, maybe, although he probably isn't enough of a two-way guy for them. I'm sure they'll kick the tires on Nick Batum, but he's going to have so many other offers. I don't know that they'll have the best shot there. But, you know, not a ton of wing options here. And then, you know, you probably aren't going to want to bring back Jeff Green for what he'll cost. Same thing with Lee. It's not exactly, with $25 million to work with, it sounds like a lot, but when you have basically two starting slots to fill in the wing, I mean, Tony Allen, who's going to be 34, is your only other wing player who's going to be under contract who's proven anything, you know, $25 million doesn't seem like so much anymore.
I like that you added the who has proven anything, so I couldn't snark and say Vince Carter's under contract for next year, too.
Well, he has proven something, I guess, which is that he's unfortunately kind of done.
I get to do this. Speaking of unfortunately kind of done, can we move on to the Los Angeles Lakers?
Well, let's talk. Actually, we should briefly discuss Jordan Adams,
yeah,
because he's shown some promise in summer league, but then he had the arthroscopic surgery, came back actually in that blowout game against the Warriors. We saw him, and maybe he actually ended up playing more minutes than was kind of he should have, just because it was such a blowout and he was on the bench. And a lot of times the coaches will just sort of throw out whoever's on the bench, just, all right, finish this game. We're not going to waste any more time with our important players. We have to have five players out there. But he then was unable to finish that game, and now he's been out again for basically 2 months since that game, where I don't know what happened, whether he tweaked it or whether he played too long or whatever. I mean, we probably don't have enough information to say for sure, but it was definitely an odd circumstance that a guy would come back for one game, probably play more minutes than he was expecting, and all of a sudden he misses two more month, and he's finally now supposedly getting close. But they really need to find out whether he can play or not, and at least be a rotation piece in these next 3 months or so, because it's going to really determine a lot in what their strategy is in free agency.
Yeah, compare what the Blazers know right now about Allen Crabbe to what the Grizzlies know about Jordan Adams. I mean, that's really what they would want, is just, even if you got the understanding that they have now, I mean, the Blazers got the benefit, I have finger quotes, of having Lillard out so they could kind of see a little bit more. But, you know, if you could get that kind of an understanding, that would be huge for the Grizzlies moving forward.
L.A. Lakers, 8-27, but 4-4 in their last eight. The Lakers are on a roll towards losing their draft pick. You had a little trivia question that you wanted to pose to me. I have not looked this up in advance. I'm going to try and get it right now. What is it?
Okay, so only two of the Lakers' 15 most used lineups this year have a positive net rating. Those lineups have four players in common, and then there are two players that are swapped. Without looking into it, what are your guesses for who the four players in common are?
D'Angelo Russell?
Not one of the ones in common.
Dow.
He's one of the swaps.
All right. How many guesses do I get? Do
you,
I get six?
You get
guesses?
Four guesses. Well, I just want to see how many you get out of four.
Oh, okay. I don't want to pick any of the starters because it seems like those units can't have done well, but I guess I'll go with Roy Hibbert.
He is one.
Okay. Larry Nance?
No.
Ugh. Well, then it's got to be Julius Randle.
I believe it is Julius Randle. I'm actually pulling it up again.
Okay,
now.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be the power forward. Jordan Clarkson?
Jordan Clarkson's the swap guy with D'Angelo Russell.
Okay. Who else would be on the floor with those guys? Lou Williams.
Yes.
All right, am I out of guesses?
Yeah, I think you're out of guesses. actually, I think Larry Nance was not one of them. Okay, so the lineup, their lineup that has been the, oh, I think it also got jacked up by the most recent game, but so one of their best lineups has been Bass, Randall, Russell, Lou Williams, and Nick Young, which is just such a crazy, crazy lineup.
Yeah, I feel like I need to, like, intervene here on some of these, like, these lineups have played 25 minutes together and have a good or bad.
I know. I'm not saying they're good or anything. It's just when a team only has two lineups that have been positive, you just kind of look for what you can get.
Is that really true? They've only had two lineups that have been positive?
In their top 15, yeah.
Oh, in their top 15 most used.
Yeah,
okay,
and then,
yeah.
When you get, I mean, the other kind of crazy thing about the Lakers is they, you know, when you're getting down to outside of their top five, you're dealing with lineups that have played less than 40 minutes together. Like, they've played a dominant amount of their minutes, have gone to basically their starting lineup, their kind of alternate starting lineup, and then just everybody else.
Any lineup that has Nick Young in it and has done well, I'm quite willing to declare that a fluke. So one thing that was a bit of controversy, despite the fact they had that nice win over Phoenix last night, Julius Randle got pulled in the fourth quarter as sort of a representative benching, basically, because that second unit wasn't defending at all, and they let the Suns back in the game. Julius wasn't too happy about that, and there are some more quotes, which are, if you care enough about it, go look at Mike Bresnahan's timeline or any of the beat writers about Scott basically saying he's a little unhappy with how Randle handles being taken out of the game. So I decided to go look and see, you know, is Julius's defense really that bad? And he's really, just like a lot of young players, just like I talked about with Jim Peterson and Wiggins, you'll see a lot of times with the young guys, they're actually pretty decent when they're straight up on the ball in isolation. And even, this doesn't apply as much to Randle as a four, but getting around screens on a pick and roll. But the problem is that anything off the ball, they're not good at. And a big part of that is just that he's never in a stance. He is pretty much always standing straight up. I think part of that, too, is just not quite being in the absolute best shape where you're just used to being in a stance all the time. And a lot of it's just mental, right? Like, and it's exacerbated when you're tired because you're sort of always looking for an excuse to relax, right? And the real good defensive players, they understand that there just is no relaxing on defense. You're always in a stance. You're always ready to do something. There is always something that you should be doing on defense, even when you're not guarding the ball. If there's any kind of action going on at all, you should be moving around, changing the angles for the offense, helping, recovering, getting into the lane, getting out of the lane, stunting towards someone. There's no just standing there straight up and down and catching a blow when you're playing NBA defense, you know, in 2015, now 2016. And that's something that Randle just really is not able to appreciate yet. And so he just spends a ton of his time off the ball standing up. And that's why he's not able to react Quickly enough, he's really bad at closing out on shooters on the perimeter, especially if he has to help first, and he's got to get better at that. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, the way I like to think about it is inertia. You know, if it takes you longer to get in motion, then that's harder, and you know, when you're tired, it just exacerbates the situation.
The Clippers, 22-13, 6-1 now, doing extremely well since the Blake Griffin injury. I mean, it's even been posited that maybe there could be better offensively without him, at least this regular season version of him that just kind of hangs out and takes some long twos. There have even been some quotes from opposing players. I want to say it was John Wall after they played the Wizards who said that they're actually harder to guard with Paul Pierce at the four, spacing out around those DeAndre Jordan and Chris Paul pick and rolls. So, you know, I don't know that I buy that ultimately, especially in the playoffs. Blake is a great player, and they've always done very well offensively around him, you know, since he's basically has joined up with Paul. But one thing that has been very encouraging for this team is that they're fourth in defense since November 20th, and 16-8 in that period. So that's basically kind of right on track to the 55-win season we thought they were going to have.
They're in a spot that is enviable but also difficult, because it really comes down to defining success. You know, if you are Steve Ballmer, if you are Doc Rivers, and you are sitting there and you go 55 wins, that's a really good season. You know, that's a really good season, but their chances of winning a championship are pretty low, especially for a team that's that good. So if you kind of have to, if you're in their position, and you kind of have to think about it both ways, and there isn't a wrong answer to that, and there isn't a right answer, but knowing which way you feel is incredibly important if your decision and your opinion matters.
It's especially discouraging for them, despite the fact that they're playing well now, because this is a team that I think if you look at the ages of their three best guys, Paul, 30, and Griffin turns 27 this year, DeAndre about the same age, you have to think that this is their best year. And, you know, J.J. Redick, I think, is going to be 32 or 33. He's getting pretty old. This is their best chance. This should be the best iteration of this team, and they're still kind of so far behind those three best teams in the conference right now that you really start to wonder, you know, what is there for this team?
Yeah, and I mean, if there are a lot of franchises in this league that if you gave them the Clippers situation, regardless of the money obligations and all that, they'd be thrilled with it. But if you want to be a flagship, especially in Los Angeles, where the Lakers are still getting that attention, even though they're moribund, I think that you have to kind of figure out what you're going to do with it. The other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit, I've beaten the DeAndre Jordan defense drum at other times, but I just find it fascinating that he is, right now, he is second in the entire league, not positionally, just second, in defensive RPM. And the Clippers are 14th, so dead middle of the road in defensive efficiency. And they allow less points per 100 possessions when he's not on the floor than when he is, which, of course, is not a fair thing, and you can talk about backups and all that. But I just find it interesting that, you know, that the kind of stats like that really like him for reasons that I just have trouble seeing.
Yeah, RPM is a little bit of a black box, and I know it can rely a little bit more on box score stats, especially earlier in the year where you don't have that much of a sample size for some of the on-off numbers, but I don't know exactly why that is. But one thing that came to mind just now, I'm kind of spitballing here, is why not try and trade him at this point and see if you can get enough guys to put you over the top with Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, because I feel like you can get a guy who is a reasonable facsimile of what he does. Not as good, obviously. Amin likes to talk about this all the time, but just sort of a jumping jack guy who can block a few shots, get some alley-oops offensively, and, you know, but who isn't as young as he is, you know, isn't as well-regarded overall, and maybe try to get some assets to get another two-way guy on the wing as well, redistribute a little bit more and see whether getting a two-way guy in the wing can make up for the fact that maybe you're not getting as good of a guy as a center as Jordan is. I think that while I'm not sure that would work, and I would have to really look into what kind of a package could be available for him. I think that that would probably be, just as a general concept, their best way to kind of roll the dice on improving, because they're never going to get equal value back for Chris Paul or Blake Griffin.
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting idea, and I think you'd be on the end of selling high. One of the other facets of his value, which is very positive beyond the fact that he plays all the time, you know, he doesn't miss many games, is that he is on a contract, as opposed to a lot of these other guys where you have the questions. Like, theoretically, let's say Dwight Howard was on the trade block. You don't know, you have no commitment from Dwight Howard that he's going to be on your team 6 months from now, much less, you know, 12 months or whatever. And so I think that DeAndre, you know, he's not on a longer contract because he signed, I think it was a 3+1, right? I think,
yeah,
so,
yeah,
so, but that's,
I mean,
still,
and
more.
He can't be traded. He can't be traded until January 15th, since he was signed with Bird Rights. But
that's,
yeah,
soon
it is.
Enough.
I mean, yeah, he's going to have value because, you know, you can, you know, you've got him. He's 26, 27. You've got him through the rest of his prime, maybe a little bit into the decline.
Yeah, like if you're Boston, let's say, like he instantly makes you a very different team. He makes you a competitive team, and they have assets out the wazoo. That'd be, I think of Boston as a fake trade place for everybody. But I think that I am very intrigued by that, and I want to pursue it further.
Yeah, that might be interesting. I mean, you could say, you know, try and get Jay Crowder and maybe, you know, another asset or two, you know, RJ Hunter, like those type of level of guys. I mean, that probably still isn't enough. But, you know, starting around that, you know, a package built around a 3-and-D guy, you know, maybe Tyler Zeller or something like that. I mean, Boston doesn't have quite like the level of jumping jack guy that you might want. But, yeah, that's an intriguing thought. Let's move on to Houston, 17-19, 3-5. I think they actually had lost four straight until tonight, where they basically, James Harden, willed them to victory on the road against the Jazz. You know, just when you think this team might be kind of turning the corner, they had that nice victory over the Spurs on Christmas, and then they lose to the Pelicans the next night, and they lose four straight, and they're under 500 again.
It feels like destiny that they're going to be the most disappointing playoff team in a long time. And that doesn't mean that they'll be, you know, bad or that they'll still be dangerous, but it feels like they're going to make the playoffs almost no matter what, because the rest of the teams are just falling apart behind them. And
yeah, I mean, none of those teams behind them have anybody as good as James Harden. I mean, and that's really probably enough to get you there.
Yeah, I think it is.
I mean, but the big key for them is, can they pass Memphis? Can they get into, because Memphis is the fifth seed right now, right?
Yeah, I think Memphis is the five seed right now.
Yeah, so and they're not that far behind Memphis, and Memphis isn't playing, you know, so amazingly either.
No, they are not.
So that's going to be the big key, is to get into that fifth seed, play the Clippers, where you have a fighting chance, because I don't think this team has any kind of a fighting chance against Oklahoma City. That's going to be, everybody's going to be kind of desperate to get in there, because you really don't have a chance against those top three teams if you're one of these kind of teams in the scrum for those last couple of playoff spots.
So Dallas is in the five right now. They're 19-15. The Grizzlies.
Oh yeah, Dallas.
The Grizzlies are two games behind them in the loss column. They're tied in the win column, which might.
Oh yeah, they're not catching Dallas, I don't think, unless something happens to Dirk.
But two quick notes on Houston just before their free throw attempt rate for December was 0.36. The only one team in the NBA was near that high last year, the Sacramento Kings, which were actually slightly above that. The Rockets were second. So that was basically like the top end that they can do in that. They're wonderful at drawing free throws. They have been since James Harden's been there. But, and on the other side, something that they also were better at last year and were terrible in November comparatively was they're forcing turnovers. They were number two in the league in forcing turnovers in December, and they were 14th, middle of the road in November, but they were fifth last year. So that's more of a, you could call it a regression to the mean, which is very encouraging for them because that helps fuel their offense.
Yeah, you could look at that one of two ways. One is that it's really good for them to force turnovers because they're going to break down at the end of possessions. I mean, we saw that in that loss to the Warriors where they're giving up a ton of backdoors. When teams start to run their offense, they don't have the discipline. They don't do a good job of communicating or switching. On the other hand, you could say, well, maybe they're forcing so many turnovers because they're gambling all the time, and that's how they're giving up so many layups at the rim as well. So that kind of cuts both ways, but it does help them get out on transition, which they're pretty good at. You know, I don't know. I still think, you know, this is would you say they are the favorite for the sixth seed, or you like Memphis better?
I'd say they're the favorite for it, just because I can be convinced that they can go, you know, that they can go on a hot streak a lot more than Memphis. I'm still flabbergasted every time Memphis beats a team by more than 10. You know, like, that's not to say that Memphis is a bad team. They can beat a ton of teams by 8. But I feel like if you were to say, oh, the Rockets went 20-10 in 30 games, I'd be like, okay, you know, that's better than I expected, but it wouldn't be shocking. Well, so I'd say they're the favorites for it right now. That's the long-winded way of saying that.
Yeah, I think I like Memphis's chances better, just because you know that they're going to give at least a decent effort most nights, which the Rockets are not. Let's move on to the Golden State Warriors. 32-2. Best start still in NBA history. A putrid 6-1 in their last 7. You had a couple of notes on what lineups have been particularly killing it for them.
Yeah, they have a lot of lineups that have been. But so the NBA's best 5-man unit with more than 100 minutes played is actually, so there's a lineup that I called the torture chamber 2 years ago, which is Curry, Iguodala, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, and Andrew Bogut, which was their best lineup before what is now called the death lineup, and then that eventually took over. But the best lineup is that same torture chamber lineup with Bogut, except with Azili in his place. They've been plus 27.3 in 109 minutes, and that lineup, you would think of it, oh, you know, that's a great defensive group, you have a lot of talented players there. They're actually the best of those 100-minute played units in offensive rating at 122.6.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is, you know, the why they're better with Azili than Bogut is because he gets on the offensive glass, he runs the floor really hard. Bogut doesn't really do either of those things too much anymore. And I think they have missed Azili's offensive rebounding. Since he's been out, they really have not gotten on the offensive glass very much. I mean, what did you take away from that game we just got back from against the Hornets?
That, you know, when this team is humming, they can knock the doors off anybody. It's a little bit concerning. It was another game, of course they're not close to 100%, where the other team just kind of lingered more than you would think with this team. But really, when a team wins functionally wire to wire, you don't want to think about, you don't like, that's not as big of a concern. But you do sit there and go, well, you know, with 5 minutes left, the team that was clearly inferior over most of the game, no insult to Charlotte, they weren't at their best in terms of physical, you know, who was on the court, that they were still, you know, one hot streak away from sending that game to overtime like the Nuggets game. So you think a little bit about that, but at the same time, this team, when they're on, is just ridiculous.
Yeah, and just towards the end, too, they kind of screwed around a little bit trying to get Draymond Green his 10th assist for his third straight triple-double. Which always is kind of, and I don't blame the players for this at all, because guess who makes a huge deal out of it? The media does. Us in the media, right? The idea that double doubles and triple doubles just get so much play because they're so rare, and, you know, I mean, most NBA players don't even come close to even getting one in their careers. I mean, you remember how important it was to Ricky Davis that he, like, threw the ball off his own backboard to try to get his 10th rebound to get a triple-double. You know, it's really a media creation that guys care so much about this, and even guys like, I mean, they're having fun. The game wasn't in jeopardy or anything like that, but it's really too bad because it doesn't make Draymond Green any better of a player to have a cheap 10th assist than if he only had 9 assists. And the reason that he's doing stuff like that is, hey, you know, media coverage leads to all-star votes. You know, even I'm sure the coaches who vote for All-Star, like, they consume media just like anyone else. They see SportsCenter highlights. They see that Draymond Green now has 3 straight triple-doubles, and he's only one of, like, 9 players to ever do that or something like that. So it's just when the measurement of players is kind of off from what actually determines that a player is good or not, that always kind of bothers me a little bit. And I think that, you know, teams and the media, we all have a responsibility to try to refocus on, all right, this is what actually makes a player good, instead of this is just some empty stat that you got and we're going to celebrate that instead.
Andrew Bogut made a really nice point on this in the post game. He said that Draymond Green has been a guy who's contributed so much off the box score, and that it's kind of nice, he said it in that way, you know, as a teammate, to see him do this in terms of the counting stats, in terms of things. Basically, so it is providing a window for people who have not seen what he has been doing to do that. So it's kind of hilarious. So he's getting celebrated for things which are involved in why he's so great, but not entirely it. But at the same point, you kind of have to feel like at this point, any press is good press, considering how underrated he's been on the aggregate, even though people like us haven't been doing that.
Yeah, and it is, you know, it's hard, right? Like, a casual fan, I can't say, oh, Draymond Green is awesome in RPM or something like that. Like, they're not necessarily going to get that.
Yeah, I mean, you can say he's been the second best Warrior, but then when you have to say why, then you start to get into the stuff where you can lose them in the weeds.
Yeah, especially when we couldn't even say why DeAndre Jordan was second in RPM. I mean, I believe in those stats. I believe in their creators, but when guys like us who basically live this stuff can't entirely explain something like that, it puts it into a little bit more relief of why, all right, most people just still are focused on points, rebounds, and assists, and you know, maybe we shouldn't be as frustrated when people are focused that much on that kind of stuff. Denver, 12-23, a disappointing 1-7, although they have been in most of these games that they lost, you know, even including that overtime thriller against the Warriors over the weekend. You had another interesting lineup tidbit for them.
Yeah, so the Nuggets have only had one lineup, so the combination of five players, that has played in more than 10 games together, and they've played 12. So you think about this, this is a team that's played 35 games, they're 12-23, and no collection of five players have played together in more than about a third of it.
Yeah, and it's not even some like dominant lineup. It was Nelson, Foy, Will Barton, Darrell Arthur, and Jokic. I mean, that's not like a lineup of stalwarts for this team by any means. You know, it's two guys you projected to be backups at the start of the year in the front court. I mean, actually, all of those guys were supposed
to be
backups.
It's backup five, as would have been the start of the year. And that's probably how they would have played it early in the year, except that Nurkic was hurt.
But that's just, you know, puts in stark relief some of the injury problems that these guys have had. Speaking of injury problems, Yusuf Nurkic came back. We saw him in person against the Warriors. Then he played again in a back-to-back against Portland the following night. So it was our first look at Nurkic. I wanted to kind of see where he looked like he was at. And, you know, it's never a death knell if a guy doesn't look amazing the first time he's back. Although he did take quite a bit longer than was originally projected with that partially torn patellar tendon to get back. I think it was supposed to be like a 4-month injury, and he had the surgery back in the spring, and you know, it's really been more like 8 months, which, you know, that's a very severe injury, so it's not a huge surprise. So it's not the end of the world that he hasn't looked amazing so far, but still, it would be better if he did look like himself, you know, the way some of the other guys coming back from injury have, you know, like Kyrie Irving, for example. Nurkic has never been a particularly explosive guy, but he really doesn't look to have any lift at all right now in the post. His hook shots, he kind of gets knocked off balance. He can't get as much lift as he wants. And he ends up kind of throwing it too hard off the backboard or being way short. I think he's 0 for 8 on hook shots that I've seen. I mean, he definitely is still very aggressive. He's been a high usage guy, you know, for a young big throughout. He had a couple of block shots or shots blocked where he's kind of rushing it. He did have his usual effectiveness on the offensive glass where he's able to kind of bully guys out of the way. I mean, he weighs 280, so that's definitely possible. His feet look okay, not amazing. He still has those quick hands. You know, he had that great steal rate in Europe coming over. Hasn't been too bad as far as getting into foul trouble. And then the other thing I thought too is that his pick and roll game has looked a little bit better. He's shown like kind of some nice floaters coming down the lane. You know, out of his, you know, 20 shots or so, I think, that he's taken so far. But I'd like to see him set harder screens as well with his big body. He's kind of been rolling early for his own offense instead of really trying to get his guys open and then using that to roll to the basket and get open instead.
Yeah, I think it'll take him a little bit of time, but I still see flashes in him that I really like. And they're also going to be in a spot where, from what I can tell, where they're probably going to pick in the draft, there aren't a ton of real center prospects, so they're not going to have to be making those real complicated decisions right now.
Yeah, and he, as we talked about a little bit on last night's program, is so essential to what they're trying to do long term. I mean, if he can really be a great pick and roll defender, a great rebounder, you know, a rim protector with his quick feet, he's not, you know, he's not going to sky to get shots in the air, but his feet are quick enough and his body is big enough that he can get his body in between drivers and the rim and force misses. If he can be a defensive stalwart good enough where you can play Gallo at the four a lot, that really opens up their offense a ton, especially then with that spacing too. He can get deep seals on guys, and that I think is more kind of what he should be concentrating on than the, like, all right, I'm going to fake you out low post, you know, long hook shot type of thing. But, you know, we'll have to watch him a little closely, check in maybe in a month or so and see, you know, kind of how some of his post moves are looking, because those hook shots have looked really, really bad, and that's just a little bit concerning to see that lack of explosion so far, but hopefully that's something that'll come back for him.
Ready to do the last team of the night?
Yes, at 12:31 a.m., I am indeed ready to do the last team of the night, the Dallas Mavericks. Now, 19-15, 3-3, and I'm sure massively aggrieved that I forgot that they're the fifth seed in the West.
Yeah, they'll have lots of time to get over that, because they're probably going to be sitting there for the next 3 months. And that's great for them. I mean, we both thought that it was going to be hard. You know, it was going to be hard for them to fight for everything.
Yeah, we had them out of the playoffs, right? I think both of us did.
Yeah, and the lesson, as always, never doubt Rick Carlisle.
And definitely doubt six other teams in the Western Conference that should be better than them, but aren't. So you've noted something that was interesting. With Wes Matthews on the floor, they've been great. Without him, not so much.
Yeah, so one of those kind of fun stats that the NBA has on the media site is that you can get kind of, you can have a kind of a panel with and without. And so the Mavericks are scoring 109.9 points per 100 possessions with Wes Matthews on the floor. That is very good. That is not the story here for me. The story is that they are only scoring 94.1 points per game without him. And when you look...
Or 94.1 per 100.
Yeah, per 100. Yeah. So... when you look for that, as we talked about a little bit with RPM, what you're looking at more is not something like that that looks weird. It's how does it compare to other things? And so the Mavericks only have one other player who they score less than 100 points per less than 100 per 100 without them, and that is Dirk Nowitzki, who I think is closer. I think he's more like about 98 from last time I looked. And so that's really interesting, because that means the rest of the starters, that means all the other guys they played, you know, Zaza Pachulia, Chandler Parsons, everybody else. And so it's just interesting. You know, I'm not saying there's anything predictive about it. It's just when you see somebody who's that kind of an outlier, I just get intrigued and want to learn more.
Yeah, if you think about it, there are not really any other wings they have. And especially maybe now with Parsons coming back and getting his regular minutes, start being in the starting lineup, that'll change a little bit. But there are not any other wings they have who really scare you from beyond the arc. Unless I'm forgetting about someone, which, you know, I've apparently been doing a lot for Dallas, but that is something where with some of those pick and rolls that they run, having a guy being able to crash in from the weak side where you're not that worried about a guy like Wes, who, despite the fact that he hasn't shot amazingly so far this year, but has picked it up a little bit lately after he had that awesome game where he was like 8 out of 10 from three or something. He still has a good reputation as a shooter, and teams aren't going to leave him, and I think that makes a really big difference compared to some of their other wings. I wanted to talk actually about J.J. Barea, who is at age 31 is having the most efficient season of his career. And I initially thought, oh, it must all be based on the fact that he's with Dirk Nowitzki again, and Dirk will be able to set that screen up top. The big stays with Dirk, and then Barea can just turn the corner and roll right in for layups all the time. But a couple of things, when I look back on his career, he actually, other than that 13-14 season in Minnesota when they had just that miserable bench, his numbers when he was in Minnesota, just in the overall box score stats, were pretty similar to what he was doing in Dallas. And then this year, actually, his shots at the rim are down quite a bit. He's taking only, I think, about 20% of his shots at the rim, when previously in his career, he's been at 28% or above most of the years, and he's shooting, so that's actually a little bit concerning. The reason he's been so efficient is he's shooting almost 40% on three-pointers, but that is way, way above his career norms. I would expect that to regress more, kind of into the 35% range, and then, you know, it's going to get back to, I think that this little run that he's on is going to probably run out a little bit once that three-point shooting reverts, because he actually hasn't been able to get to the rim as much as he has in previous years.
Yeah, he'd be on the narrow list of guys who had the best season of their career after the stretch provision had been used on them.
What did he get stretched? I think he just got.
He might have just gotten waived.
He got bought out.
Bought out. Yeah, I think. Yeah, that's what it was. Oh man, if he got stretched, yeah, because I was thinking that might not. That doesn't happen very often. Like, I don't think it's gonna happen with Martell Webster.
But. Yeah. All right. Let's get out of here. Anything to plug?
Nothing out yet. Hopefully have some stuff out soon.
Yeah, I would say just listen to that Jim Peterson podcast from last week if you get a chance. You're interested in the Wolves and kind of what their future is. We talked a lot about Towns and Wiggins, how they can develop, what guys can fit around them, and Jim is one of the best in the business. So I really recommend listening to that one. It's something that, you know, should be green for a fair amount longer. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, I am Nate Duncan NBA. I'm usually live tweeting games with this sort of analysis 2 or 3 times a week. Danny is Danny LaRue. And you can also support the podcast using that Capspace code with SeatGeek, or give us an iTunes review or rating. Those are very much appreciated as well. So thanks to Danny for coming on. We'll talk to you all next time.